This is How Success Happens, where the staff of Entrepreneur chats with innovators, writers, artists, chefs, and a range of other unique personalities to better understand the traits that make excellence possible.
Nobody in Silicon Valley thinks it's actually them. They think everybody else is like this.
One of my regrets actually now, we should have pulled the plug sooner.
It's amazing when the universe sees you commit, how all of a sudden all these resources start to come together.
Thanks for joining us. And now, How Success Happens. Hey, I'm Dan Bova, editorial director of Entrepreneur.com. You know, I didn't know what to expect when we scheduled an interview over breakfast with today's guest, Andrew Zimmern. As you may know, the chef, writer, restaurateur, and TV personality made a name for himself traveling the world and eating very bizarre foods on his hit show, Bizarre Foods. Well, turns out our breakfast turned out pretty normal. We didn't dig into a fresh plate of scrambled brains or anything, but the conversation was anything but. See, over the past couple of years, Zimmern has built a true empire around his name with books, TV shows, restaurants, including his new Twin Cities joint, Lucky Cricket, and a production company. But as he very candidly told me, it wasn't easy. He has gone through a lot of personal pain on his journey. Over the course of his life, he's had his share of problems with substance abuse, personal relationships, even homelessness. But he was very open about sharing the lessons he learned along the way about coping and finding redemption. We also spoke about his dear friend, Anthony Bourdain, and about the struggles of feeling overwhelmed that most of us face. But don't get me wrong, he's really funny too. There's nothing quote-unquote normal about Andrew Zimmern. Hope you'll enjoy our conversation, but first, a word from our sponsors.
For most of us, the vitamin aisle at the drugstore is a pretty intimidating place. Unless you've done lots of research, it's hard to know which vitamins you need and how many to take. That's why I was very excited to try Care Of, a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers personalized vitamin and supplement packs right to your door. Here's how it works. Head to takecareof.com and take their online quiz that asks you all about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices. It takes only 5 minutes to find out what specific vitamins and supplements you need, and the quiz is easy and fun. Then your vitamins get delivered right to your door in personalized, easy-to-remember daily packs. It's a super convenient way to get your day off to a healthy start. Something I especially appreciate about Care Of is that they provide all the research behind their vitamin recommendations, backed by a scientific advisory board. And check out this special offer. For 25% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, visit takecareof.com and enter the promo code HSH. Again, go to takecareof.com and enter the promo code HSH for 25% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins. Your body will thank you.
And now for our second sponsor.
Incredible starts when you have an expert who knows your business. It starts with TriNet, human resources that tailor a strategy for success for small and medium-sized businesses. So no matter what industry you're in, you can grow with confidence. See how TriNet's industry-focused HR can give you more at TriNet.com. Incredible starts here. TriNet.
So we could jump right into it if
Let me grab some coffee and... Do you want coffee?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, and do you have the avocado toast? Yeah, I'll do an avocado toast. Because that's very chic at this moment.
I would have imagined you would order something a little bit more adventurous for breakfast.
Avocados, by the way, come from the Nahuatl word, which is a group of the Aztecs, meaning testicle. Because of the way the avocados grow on the tree. So you could interpret it as being something that's quite strange in itself.
Okay.
If you chose to go down that route. So
as long as the word might mean testicle,
yes.
It's on your menu.
Also, what society in the world would take, you know, seeds and grind them and mix them with water to make, you know, something called bread? Cook it with fire, and that just sounds very strange to me.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned that you're already having a hectic morning. So How so? And is that unusual for you?
No, all the mornings are hectic because there's always things to do.
Right.
I mean, I think for people like me who are serial entrepreneurs who have trouble saying no to things,
okay,
who come up with more ideas than they're able to execute against,
sure,
then bring them inside to their company where lots of other people are, their job is to shoot holes in them and decide what's manageable and what's doable and what you can execute against, what can have an actual strategy, what can be operationalized, fights against the nature that I have, which is to kind of make everything expensive and unwieldy. That's my superpower.
That's what you're really
good
at. But
then other people, you know, the five ideas a week get narrowed down to like two or three per month that actually get worked on, and those usually tend to fit in some kind of...
What's that process like of whittling ideas down to what's actually something that's sustainable? And
For me, it's fucking brutal.
Yeah, I bet.
Because, you know, exaggerating to make a point, you know, as a creative entrepreneur, mm-hmm, I come in with like, okay, moon launch. We're gonna go to the moon.
Right.
And everybody else is like, we don't have the money. We're not scientists. The moon launch is not in our core competency.
Okay.
You know, and it just keeps going from there. And so a lot of things get discarded by, you know, an amazing team that I have in Minnesota. And the rest of the ideas make it through different meetings and go through different filters where folks who are way more practical and left side brained types, I think it is, then start attacking it. And eventually you wind up with stuff that are good ideas that you just can't activate at the time. Maybe you don't have time, the actual physical time. Maybe you don't have the money. Maybe you don't have staff to execute against that. But you love it, and you can go out and find people to help you do that. Things can be outsourced. I don't know, Dan Sullivan? Do you know who Dan Sullivan is?
Yeah.
So, you know, Dan Sullivan, I've never had a chance to meet him, but I read all his stuff, and I look at all his stuff online, and he has a presentation that he's done. I mean, he's done weekend seminars on, but he's distilled it down to a 3-minute video that I actually show everybody that comes to work for me. I sit down and go through it with them. And it's essentially, it's easier to grow a business or an idea 10x than it is to 2x.
Mm.
So if you embrace 10x thinking, you're gonna be living in a 10x world and doing 10x deals.
Okay.
That's his general system. My favorite part of the whole video is he essentially says you have to have the ability, some kind of filter that allows you to discard what isn't gonna work. And he then has the sentence, you can then either throw it away,
mm-hmm,
or outsource it.
Okay.
So, you know, outsourcing is a really important part of, you know, the entrepreneur's life. And the easiest example of that is you're doing a book, right? Book's a great idea. Book is, you know, everyone loves. Okay, you've hit on something. We think it can sell. But obviously, we can't physically, in my office, publish a book. We have to outsource that to somebody else.
Well, it strikes me in your life that I've read about and we've come to see you on TV is that your life is a kind of 10x living. You don't just do a cooking show or a travel show.
Mm-hmm.
You take it a couple of steps further.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been with you your whole life? Is that something that's just inside you that you want to go big with everything you do?
Yes.
And has that always been to your benefit, or does that sometimes put you in places that...
It was never to my... There was a point in my life where it was never to my benefit at all.
Okay.
Because I had no structure
around
it. Once you sort of put some structure around it and you bring in other people to help you with it, then it becomes something that's possible.
Right.
I mean, putting rules around it and, you know, listening to teammates and stuff like that then allows some of those things to happen. And for a long time, it was just me. Well, for a long time, it was me just making foolish big ideas.
Right. Okay.
Right. If
what's one idea that you look back on and just shake your head?
I mean, it was high school.
Okay.
I mean, we decided that, and it almost sounds in a weird way like a drug deal in a sense. Like,
okay.
We're gonna organize the high school ski trip, my friends and I, and
okay.
we're gonna make all the arrangements, and we will book the 100 rooms at Stowe at the place where everyone's gonna bunk up. So we need 50 rooms. We're gonna sell 100 tickets, and we're gonna get a discount price on this, and we're gonna get the meals funded by that. Okay, that's it. Everyone else is responsible for everyone else. That's in those days, this is the 70s. You know, that's $20,000, right?
Right.
So 100 people, that's $200 a person, right? And with that $20,000 and $200 a person, we'll have 5 slots paid for free, tossed in. That's going to be like our head stash. That's going to be our, that's how we're going to afford to do this without us coming up with the $200.
Okay.
Dollars. And the whole thing, the trip went off.
Okay.
It happened, but which is a great achievement, but we burned a lot of bridges and we caused a lot of pain for people along the way because everyone else was on the bus,
uh-huh.
right, going up to Stowe, and we were driving in my friend's car, and everyone else was in these bunk rooms at the lodge at Stowe, and we were in regular rooms at like the Green Mountain Inn, you know, and it was just it was awful. I mean, you know, as a young, that's what happens when you convince yourself that what you're doing is the right way to do it.
Right.
As opposed to running it by someone, which just seems like the most obvious thing in the world. But I think a lot of people sometimes take off on things and don't talk to the right people.
Right.
And so now that filter system of talking to the right people, really analyzing it, seeing if we can develop a strategy around it, how do we operationalize that strategy, and will it work out for all parties, is a much more mature way to take a look at that. But I have, yes, always been a 10X guy. I mean, if we're going to have a party, well, let's get a great band. And everyone is saying that costs money, slow down, wait. It's like, no, we'll do it first, and then we'll figure out the nuts and bolts of it, and that's not very healthy.
So you're kind of fixing the car as you're driving down the road 100 miles per hour kind of guy.
It's ready, fire, aim kind of thing, but yes, that's exactly, it's fixing the flat tire while the car is moving.
So I think a lot of people know you, obviously, from your show and your books about bizarre foods, and you've got a lot of other things going on. You've got businesses, and you're actually opening a new restaurant, right?
Yep.
So how do you sort of juggle all that stuff? How do you stay productive? How do you stay focused on what you need to stay focused? And I always ask people like you, who the brand is you, how do you like trust other people to handle stuff that's you? And I'm making air quotes for people who can't see.
Those are three really distinct ideas. How do I stay focused? With the help of a lot of people to remind me and some intense personal organization.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a mind that doesn't forget anything.
Mm.
So when I have a brief conversation with someone from 6 months ago saying, hey, let's get these cool coffee cups, at some point later on, if those cups don't appear, I will look at someone and say, where are the coffee cups?
Okay.
And, I just have this endless list in my mind because I don't sleep and I'm kind of hyper and manic and, all the rest of that. How you execute, has become easier. Hire the right people in your office to help you with that, who think differently than you do. And, bringing in partners for things. I am I think the secret to my success in many ways has been sharing and being a good sharer, you know. I'll give you a great example. The restaurant, I needed a really great operations partner. I'm on the road shooting. I've got a lot of other businesses. It took me years and years to find the right operations partner. I think I did. With our television production company, Intuitive Content, we've been extremely successful in the last couple of years, have seen us, within 3 years, we're now in the black. Now, for a production company, that's really, really good. Mm. And we're growing with a good reputation for making great television and great branded content. So double bonus. So part of that was hiring the right person to run the business, which I did, and letting them do their job, which is hard.
Yeah.
But we figured out a system in our office to how to get enough of my DNA into each project, stuff that I've learned over the course of my life and mostly through doing a lot of work on myself over the years. I learn a lot of ideas in my recovering life and just apply them to my business life. So with the content, with Intuitive Content, a lot of people aren't in the position financially because the bottom line for production companies is that margins are really thin, mm-hmm. and you get paid at the end.
Right.
Right. In the world of commercial television. If you're doing a $5 million project, you get, 10% of a production fee, but that's the last check. So it's not like you're deficit financing it because someone else is paying for all the bills, but you're not realizing any profit until the show is over. So you have to do enough projects and enough branded content and enough other things to kind of keep cash flowing your business because problems happen. You're not budgeting for needing a new Xerox machine.
Right.
Or buying light bulbs in the office.
Right.
More so buying light bulbs in the office because you have office fees and stuff. But it's a very, very tricky sort of thing. Most people, because the margins are thin, don't want to share. Right? Mm-hmm. We would rather do 5 projects where we're in co-production with someone and make less money, but keep the lights on and keep working and little by little replace those deals with different kinds of deals that are more beneficial for us. So we're really good sharers, there's a lot of ways in which you talked about being productive with my staff and stuff. We actually have a policy, a process sheet for when deals come in the door, that we have a group of people who aren't me, that determine, yes, this is something worth pursuing. Not necessarily doing, but worth pursuing and spending some time on because their time is money. Then the team sits down with me and I get to put in my 2 cents. And mm-hmm. I call that the co-regulation phase.
Okay.
So that way, the things that I want to do, like, I want to make sure there's a charitable component to this. I want to make sure this group has a marketing plan that puts me out on the road talking about this thing, whatever it is. I want to make sure that project, they wanted it to be live action. I think it's better off being animation. Mm-hmm. So I'm the animate. So they can co-regulate with me, get my input, and then they go off and try to make the deal. And if we do it the right way on our side, I come back into the phase before the contract goes out to the client for whatever it is, or the deal memo or the agreement. And I then can take a pass over it. And, my team knows that if along the way they're like, absolutely not, we won't do animation, they'll come back to me and say, I know you're hung up on animation.
Right.
They don't want to do it. And that could either then be determined to be a deal buster or not.
So you are hardly rubber stamping things. You are hardly slapping your name on products and cash and checks.
The exact opposite. Yeah. I think that my team in general, rubber stamping may be too pejorative a phrase, but let's go with it for a second. I think they would be happy if there were more things that they could rubber stamp.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, easier kind of things. And I'm sure if I looked at our, we have 45 or 46 active contracts with groups right now spread out amongst our three businesses. I'm sure 10% of them, I'm sure there's four or five that someone came in, I said, oh, great idea, and they just made happen.
And I actually did rubber stamp.
Those are rather simple.
Okay.
And those usually fall into the category of either personal appearances or spokesperson work. So they'll come to me and say, hey, do you want to go talk at the University of Wisconsin student body? They have an annual lecture series, and, you know, my agent at WME has set this up, and I'm being paid, and there's a rider. You know, I have to fly down. A car has to pick me up. They have to feed me and house me overnight and return me to the house. So if I like the idea and the date is clear and someone in my team comes to me and says, here you go, I'll rubber stamp that. You know, this was something, I know it seems small and there's no monetary transaction, so certainly it's easier to rubber stamp, but you know, someone calls me and says, do you want to, I know it's last minute, do you want to do it? And I said yes right away. I would not have said yes if it wasn't you or you were from a different entity.
Okay.
And the reason is that over the course of my career, it's like, yeah, when a show comes out or a book comes out, I want to reach as broad an audience as possible.
Yeah.
But in the main, I think the people at my PR group who've been working with me for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years know that I would much rather have a really good conversation with someone who actually asks good questions and knows what they're talking about. And that's not everybody in your industry. But I find those to be more successful, and I get to talk about the things that interest me. So that gets like rubber stamped right away because I've already co-regulated with a trusted partner of ours.
I'm going to use this recording for my annual review, by the way.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. And for the record, I didn't pay you to say any of that.
Yeah, no, it's true. The co-regulate, you know, human beings, you know, if you want to really have an honest relationship and be in something with another human being, it's constant co-regulation before you move to operationalizing.
Right.
And if you walk in the door to our office and we're cubicle mates and you're like, oh my God, it's been the worst morning ever. You know, the dog crapped on the carpet and I was 20 minutes late to work because I had to clean it up. And the car isn't working, and I don't know how I'm going to pay for that because, you know, it's my wife's birthday this week, and we're doing the romantic getaway to San Juan for 4 days, and, you know, all of our annual reviews are coming up, and I'm just absolutely freaking out. What you don't need is for me to start telling you how to solve your problems.
Right.
That's not co-regulation. And
right.
Most people jump immediately to that operationalization component. It's like, wow, sounds like you should have your dog, you know, checked to the vet, and maybe you want to think about leasing that car so you don't have to worry about whatever. And you know, I do know a cheaper hotel in San, you know, and it's like you're like, look, I don't need you to solve my problem. I just need you to listen.
Yeah.
And tell me, oh my God, that sounds fucking awful.
Right.
Last week that happened to me. You know, is there anything I can do to help?
Right.
I mean, that's co-regulation.
Yeah.
And when you do that, then there's some empathy in the conversation, and then you can operationalize that.
Right.
You can say, oh my God, you know something? You can. I'm worried about my car. Can you pick me up tomorrow on the way to work? Then I don't have to worry about it.
Sure.
And I'm going to be less anxious. And, you know, so co-regulation prior to strategizing and operationalizing is a really valuable tool that I learned, you know, doing intimacy and trauma workshops over the last 7 years of my own personal recovery. I didn't learn that at business school.
Right.
You know? It's
No,
it's importing good ideas from other parts of your life and applying them to other parts.
Well, you know, I did want to talk a bit more about that, in that, you know, the entrepreneurial life is, you know, besides the business part of it, it's extremely stressful.
Yes.
It can be extremely lonely.
Yes.
Oftentimes people don't know who to turn to, and then those things carry over into other aspects of their life. So, you know, as you've been talking...
God, that sounds horrible.
Yeah. Why are you doing this? But you've been talking about your recovery life, and, you know, just to let the listeners know, like, you know, what has your journey been to this point? You know, you didn't go from running a ski trip to running this, like, giant business. There's been some in between there.
No, but it's a great bracketing, because the guy who was organizing the high school ski trip with his friends was a scam artist. That version of me was kind of running scared in life and not telling anyone. He already had become an addict, an alcoholic, but didn't know it,
mm-hmm.
or wasn't willing to concede to his innermost self that he was. There was no self-appraisal or accurate way of, you know, looking inward. No system or guiding principle for living. And this person was already at that point, though not completely a user of people and taker of things, well on his way to being someone who was really only a user of people and a taker of things. My chemicals, my booze became, you know, the filter through which I judged everything. That was my filter.
Yeah.
Everything revolved around getting high, one way or another. And all the decision-making was based around that. So somehow I managed to hold it together. From the high school ski trip, age 17, I sobered up when I was 30, for another 13 years.
Wow.
Right? Now, along the way, I kept going down, 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 down. For a while, I was a very typical type of high-functioning addict alcoholic, in that I was able to have successes at work, during the day I was... you know, presented one way, and then at night was completely off the rails.
Sure.
That then, you know, it wasn't very long before my dark side started to affect my lighter side I was presenting to the world. And you start to lose friends, start to lose jobs. I mean, and then you become unfriendable, unemployable, and then you become non-functioning.
Right.
And so the last 3 years of my, my using days, I was non-functional. I was, you know, in an apartment, drinking around the clock, unemployable, unlovable. Parents thought I was dead. Eventually got evicted from that apartment by the sheriff of New York. There is a sheriff.
New York.
He does evictions.
He's out there on a horse right now?
Yeah, kind of. It's pretty funny. Huh? It's the sheriff's office. I'm a born and bred New Yorker. I was like, sheriff. I remember one of the few things I remember about that day when they knocked on my door was saying, like, sheriff. I mean, like, and I was hammered. I was like, sheriff of Nottingham? I mean, it was the most ludicrous sort of thing. Well, there is a sheriff of New York.
Wow.
And I then found myself out on the street, went down to the local, you know, shot and beer bar that I'd been drinking in, with a bunch of people that were, you know, some homeless derelicts, some people about to be, and essentially stayed there all day drinking. And the late night crowd, there were some people who knew some other folks in the bar who were squatting the building on Sullivan Street. Now, these were guys that were in the bottle gang around the corner, and, you know, they would beg, borrow, and steal money, and then they could come inside and have a real drink and warm up and, you know, a really tawdry bar over in the low 40s on 11th Avenue. I mean, it was not, it's not very glamorous.
Yeah, okay.
And I ended up going with them down to Lower Manhattan. And, you know, there was a building there. We were squatting on Sullivan Street, and I got a corner and threw my dirty clothes down there. And I was, you know, a homeless person, basically for those 11, I consider that homelessness.
Yeah.
For 11 and a half months, you know, didn't shower, didn't do any, you know, stole to feed my habits. And eventually sobered up January of 1992.
So what was, all right, so you're describing a pretty intense existence.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, you're living like an animal. There's nothing glamorous.
Is there a moment when you're sleeping on a pile of rags where, you know, this version of you that I'm sitting across from now is in your head like
absolutely
this could
not.
Be?
In fact, quite the opposite. What actually delivered me into this version was the conviction that there were winners and losers in life and that I was a loser. You know, this was obvious. All I had to do was look back at the last 10 years of my life, had every chance, every advantage in life, came from a nice, well-to-do New York City family, went to the best schools, educated the best way, and look how I had screwed up.
Right.
And so I checked myself. I stole some jewelry from a friend's mother, hocked it, got together a little nest egg, went to the San Pedro Hotel. Now, the San Pedro Hotel was a flophouse hotel in the East 50s. And it was the kind of place where, you know, there's no services. You know, it's a room.
Yeah.
There is a phone. You have to put a deposit down for the phone. I just yanked the cord out of the wall. I mean, I was there to drink myself to death. You know, I wasn't there to do anything else. And after, you know, I always, when I tell the story, I always say it's 3 or 4 days. It could have been 2 or 3.
Okay.
I mean, but my best guess is 3 or 4 days. I was drinking around the clock and woke up one day, or came to, really. I don't think I ever really slept. But I came to and I wasn't dead. And I reached out and called my best friend, something completely uncharacteristic, because that was not my MO. I was the rip the phone cord out of the wall guy.
Right,
in my apartment, when I had one, there were 3-year-old newspapers on the floor. I mean, it was... I was not a reach out and stay in touch with my friends kind of guy. And called a friend, asked for help. 25 minutes he was there, tried to clean me up in his house for a couple days. And then I walked into an intervention and a one-way plane ticket to Minnesota and stayed there, stayed sober and started my life again. And I am one of those, what's that book, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten?
Yeah.
I am one of those, Everything I Needed to Learn and know I learned in recovery.
Wow.
The idea for the show is based on recovering principles that I learned the first couple months that I was clean. People look at bizarre foods, which, you know, arguably is how most people know me best, is not a show about a fat white guy that goes around the world and eats bugs. That show is about teaching patience, tolerance, and understanding in a world that doesn't have a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, and in a country where we define ourselves by our differences, I mean, just look at, you know, our current situation.
Yeah, right.
You know, and, you know, I said, let's start defining ourselves by the things that we have in common. What are our commonalities? And I thought food was the best way to investigate another culture.
Right, absolutely. Everyone eats, right? Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you, you know, one of your good friends had a show with a similar sort of take on the world, Anthony Bourdain, and you've spoken about your closeness with him. And, you know, I think no matter what industry or whether or not you watched his show religiously, you know, what happened with him came as a great shock and a great reminder to people to do what you did eventually, which is to reach out if you're having problems. And, you know, what's it like to be on the other side of that, where, you know, you have a friend who you didn't know something was going on with and you wish you could have been there for them?
Brutal.
Yeah.
I've lost, and this is going to sound really morbid, but if you're actually head, ass, and overcoat into recovery and you're doing service in the recovery world, And that is, those are my vitamins. That's my gymnasium. That's my Ironman workout, is doing service work for people. That's my fuel. Takes me out of my head, out of my problems. And it's, I mean, without it, I'd be a mess. But doing service work for other people keeps me right-sized. And I'm not trying to paint myself as a saint. I make mistakes all the time, and there's lots of regrets. I mean, I'm a human being.
Right.
But in embracing that, I keep my head on somewhat straight. And so Tony was not the first person that I've lost in my life that way. A couple times a year, I lose someone I know or a friend to suicide. And it's really hard to rationalize, you know, because it's not rational.
Right.
It's worse when it's a friend. It's worse when it's a friend that has so much of the same story that you do.
Right.
That is, you know, even down to family makeup, you know. And it's even worse when you actually have spent recent time with that person actually talking about those things. And that makes it really, 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 really hard.
Yeah.
Now, in some cases, you're trying to explain the unexplainable. I read everything. I actually, at one point, 7 or 8 years ago, lost two friends in two different ways, you know, back to back within a month. One was an overdose that I believe was, you know, suicide by needle. And because this person was a very accomplished druggie, they knew what they were doing. And it wasn't one of those, oh, the dope is stronger now.
Right.
It was, I think, a conscious move. And the other person hung themselves in a jail cell because they relapsed after 20 some odd years and were in a county or, you know, city lockup waiting to be processed, you know, drunk tank or whatever. And I think the shame of going back to the family and saying I blew it.
Yeah.
I put together 20 some odd years was just too much. It was just too much. So the explanations for these things for so many people, you know, though they feel the world is better off without them, they, you know, I mean, we've seen the litany
of
stuff. I mean, we lost so many people, you know, back to back to back to back to back over the course of several years before Tony. It is unexplainable. It is unexplainable.
Right.
And so it's kind of like asking when I sobered up, you know, my spiritual gurus told me, let go of that question about why I drank, right? Yeah. The fact is you're an alcoholic, you drank. Move forward.
Okay.
Over the course of your sobriety, reasons will become apparent, you know, some of which were causal, but most of it was because you were, you know, self-centeredness run riot. You were looking out only for yourself. There's actual things, markers along the way. Compartmentalizing your life, I try to leave, I have to have my privacy.
Yeah.
There are things that I would like to be shared just between me, my family, whatever.
Sure.
But non-compartmentalization, or, you know, let's not use a double negative, you know, living my life in a more open way, transparent way, talking about this kind of stuff. Some people see that as a sign of weakness. Right? I see it as a sign of strength. I think asking for help is a sign of strength. And I have proof in my own life to do that. But unless you really embrace sobriety, head, ass, and overcoat, and it doesn't matter how you do it. You do it with books. You do it with religion. You do it with 12 steps. You do it. I mean, whatever gets you well is great.
Yeah.
You know, I did it the old-fashioned way in the 12 steps. I'm still very active in that part of my life. It gives me a design for living that works for me, and it makes it easier.
Right.
You know, I rely on the wisdom of, you know, 80 years of, you know, the group to navigate things. What was worse about Tony's passing for me personally was that we were close and we shared more about what was really going on in the last 2 years of his life than we had in the previous 12, 13 combined.
Wow.
He had ended a relationship with his wife. The world thought he was divorced. Apparently he wasn't. Surprise to me when we, after his passing, found out that he wasn't. Had a beautiful daughter who mm-hmm. I had come to know. And I never met his first wife, but Otavia, his second, the mother of his child, you know, fantastic human being that I had gotten to know pretty well also. And I was talking to him, you know, it's been printed, you know, already, it's out there, you know, my marital status was changing. And, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, deserving to be happy, finding the love of your life, you know, all this
right.
kind of stuff. And he was so bullish on it all that it really came to me as a surprise that someone who felt that he had figured it all out.
Right.
Now there are, you know, a bunch of reasons that I challenged him on with that assessment, just as friends.
Sure.
But the commonality that we had of spending 200 plus years on the road and all this other kind of stuff and having children that we didn't get to see as much as we wanted to, it really shook me because we had so many totally different people. Different shows, different everything. He's tall with a big head of hair. I'm, you know, not so tall with no hair. I mean, you know, like everyone, there's obvious differences.
Yeah.
But we had the same job, the same ambitions. We're the same sort of creative people. We, you know, and our family makeup was similar. So you sit there and you say, oh my gosh, am I deluding myself? You have to check yourself out. It was really, really, really hard. And then I shouldn't say just like anyone else because I had the privilege to know a different side of him. But, you know, he was one of the great cultural icons of our time and the most charismatic man that I ever met.
Yeah.
At the same time as those who know me, you know, a very shy guy that, you know, was, you know, before he came out and said it in some interview or one of his books, I remember him saying, I would be so happy living a feral life with my baby in Vietnam.
Right.
You know, and he really meant it, you know. But here was someone, you know, titanically impactful on our culture. And to see your heroes go that way is tough for a lot of people to deal with. Still is.
Absolutely. You know, well, building off of that, what's your kind of like dream of living feral on a beach? Is there some version of that for you?
Yeah, I have it in my head. You know, this is going to sound really awful, but you know, every coastal place that I visit, I'm always like, I should just buy a little beach shack here because my dream is to have, you know, a little, you know, 20-foot Zodiac or, you know, Boston Whaler, a little, you know, cottage a mile in off the ocean with access through a slough to the backside of a dune that I can walk over and be on the ocean because I can't afford a $20 million ocean house.
Right, okay.
And I'd rather sort of be tucked away in private. It's, you know, Prince of Tides, you know, the opening credits with those beautiful pictures. And, you know, the dog and a constant rotation of friends and family that come and visit me and I can cook buckets of crabs for, and it's very idyllic.
So that seems like you could do that tomorrow if you wanted to. So why aren't you?
Because I'm too addicted to the hustle.
Okay. Okay.
You know, I'd be sitting down there thinking of like, oh my God, I got to get on a plane and go to New York because I have this idea for this thing. I
mean, right.
I remember at one point doing some therapeutic work, and the idea of quitting my job, getting off the merry-go-round.
Yeah.
That for many people, the entertainment business and what I do is, you know, it's a merry-go-round. And we started to explore that idea. And the counselor that I was talking to, and there were other family members in the room, was, you know, sort of said, okay, let's play that out. Like, what do? Let's just pick something.
Sure.
You know, and so, of course, you're paralyzed. Like, what does that mean? I'm going to pick the wrong thing. And he really, what I pick is, you know, he's going to analyze that, you know, but he really just meant, like, pick anything. And yeah. I'm like, okay, I'm going to work in a shoe store. I love shoes. Guys says, okay, so you're working in a shoe store, you know, 9 to 5, everything's going great. You go home for dinner every night. You leave work at home because you're just selling shoes. You don't have any management decisions or anything else like that. You're just cashing a paycheck. And I was like, oh yeah, that sounds great. Reminded me of the first couple months of my work when I got out of treatment. I was working in a halfway house and I was a busboy and a dishwasher in a little, you know, diner, coffee shop in St. Paul. And really was 3 of the best months of my life before I got back into the restaurant thing. And I was like, oh yeah, that's great. And he goes, okay, so you're doing that for a while. What's your next move? And I thought back to that dishwashing job. And, you know, within 3 months I had walked in and taken over a restaurant for someone, because that's just how I do it. And, you know, so I said, well, you know, I guess I would want to open my own shoe shop. You know, I'd probably be pretty good at selling shoes, and you develop a clientele and you find a couple lines that you like, and the salespeople come in and you sneak a couple business cards while your boss is looking, and you find a piece of real estate and you take it to with friends, you know. And I'm like, then I have my own shoe shop. And the counselor looked at me and said, and then what happens? And like right away, without even thinking, I just said, I try to put 500 of them in China. And he said, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So now you're off, you're spending half your year in China. You're doing an American sneaker store in China.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. That would be a really cool thing. And it's like, that's how my mind works. So his point was, you're never going to be happy selling shoes.
You're not built to.
That's
just
his metaphor. You're not, that's not the way you think.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's awesome.
I mean, a current example, current real example, I wrote a kid's book, right? And when we were going through, you know, final galleys and last minute, you know, you got one day to make any last adjustment. This was a project years in the making.
Okay.
I changed the cover from being, you know, the title of the book sort of stayed the same. But the publisher and the editor were like, you need to lose the phrase, the Alliance of World Explorers, because the title is too unwieldy.
Okay.
And so I said, okay, so put that on the banner at the top, Alliance of World Explorers, Volume 1.
Okay.
And then the title of the book is AZ and the Lost City of Ophir.
Okay.
And they're like, okay, talk to us about that. I'm like, well, now we have the banner for the series of books. And they're like, oh, this is going to be a series of books. And I'm like, well, yeah, because this one's going to be successful and I want the adventures of these kids to continue.
Right.
And, you know, so to me...
And that's the decision you make on the last day before this...
Well, that's when it occurred to me.
Yeah, okay.
But it had been inside me.
Right.
I mean, identifiable.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not using that as a metaphor. Yeah. I mean... I'd thought about that a long time, and I realized I never articulated that to everybody else, that to me, this was going to be the next Captain Underpants and ultimately a ride at Disney World.
And that's literally my goal. And other people are like, well, isn't the goal just like, let's just make the book successful and take it from there? I'm like, well, I'm going to assume the book's going to be successful. That's like the goal for someone for whom that's enough. And in complete honesty, that's not enough for me. Every single thing that I do,
right,
I want to have this much larger goal to strategize and operationalize against, because that's the fun of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't hit all the time, but I'm definitely someone who believes that, you know, when it does, then you make a really big impact. And I want, because everything I do has a social justice component to it, I want it to be as successful as it can, or has the potential to be. Why wouldn't you? Why would you keep it small?
Right, right.
It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I like to ask people, you know, how do you define success for yourself? And I think you just did, which is that there's no end point to it.
Well, there is no end point to it. It is a constant. It is a constant.
Right.
You're always going.
Right.
Now, there are exceptions to that. I mean, there are certain people who are brilliant entrepreneurs. They're really only good at one thing.
Right.
Right. Like coding computers. And they leverage that into owning one of the biggest tech companies in the world. They eventually get into charitable works and a family and all the rest of that. But, you know, if you've met them early on, you're like, wow, that guy has one superpower, and that's awesome.
Right.
And then you grow, right?
Yeah.
For me, success is measured, you know, by, you know, the impact, the change, the healthy change in impact that your legacy has on our planet. I mean, I shat all over myself and over a lot of people for a long, long time. And there is some kind of cosmic, karmic thing that exists where I know I'm trying to make up for lost time.
Mm.
I know I'm trying to make amends for a lot of shitty things I did, you know, the first 30 years of my life. I know where this comes from. And it's, to me, it's a healthy channel of that energy.
Yeah.
I think I've made a lot of things right with the universe already. But I don't want people at my funeral to be looking back and saying, yeah, he was a kind of a schmuck and then he tried to do the right thing.
Right.
I want people to say, yeah, he was a kind of a schmuck and look at the amount of change for the better that he left in the wake of his boat as he sped across the lake. Too fast, to be sure, but a great fucking boat.
Well, I can't think of a better way to wrap this up. That's pretty awesome.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Oh, no,
really,
thank you for the
time.
Opportunity.
That's our episode. We hope you enjoyed it. How Success Happens comes out every week. To catch each episode, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Like, share, and leave us a review so we can always be improving. Go to entrepreneur.com for more episodes of this show and for our other great podcasts. That's entrepreneur.com. Thanks.